Welcome to RCR Talk with Marie, and joining me now, Dr. James Lindsay, founder of New Discourses, writer, and one of the clearest voices on cultural Marxism in the modern conversation. Dr. Lindsay, welcome along, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you are in New Zealand at the moment. You've been here on an FSU tour for a few days. Impressions, how are we going on this woke journey?
Well, you know, it's I've had this question put to me in a number of countries now, and I had to finally realize, I'm like, wow, things are going great everywhere, including Canada. But I had to realize the people who come to see me presents a kind of a selection bias. So I can only tell you that my general impressions with the Kiwi situation are better than Australia, better than Canada, better than the UK, worse than the US. So somewhere in there, and the people who've come to hear me out are very eager to learn and very excited to learn. And so that's a very positive development. You're certainly behind the US on, I think it's like any virus, best to think of that it follows a trajectory, an arc. And, you know, the United States seems to be very near the crest of that arc, probably, at least culturally speaking. We'll see how it plays out politically. And New Zealand's a few years behind us. And I would say, you know, Australia is a little bit behind that, is my guess. And unfortunately, I don't think Canada, I think they're running the other direction, and the UK is maybe too.
Yeah. I guess with Canada, a lot will depend with their election coming up later on in the year. The UK has been such an outlier with their election, and they are certainly circling the drain politically from a cultural standpoint, I think. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You were just there for the ARC conference. I mean, is the vibe concerned amongst those in the freedom and liberty space?
Yes, certainly in the liberty space, concerned almost bordering on alarm. Or a resigned resignation, you know, just a defeated resignation that this is what it is. On the other hand, what I thought was most interesting, and maybe it's just coincidental to where I was, I'm not sure, but this is the first time, and I visit the UK, you know, somewhat regularly. This is the first time I've been to the UK where I definitively said that this feels like I'm in a socialist country. So the overall mood is less enthused, less engaged, not my problem. Kind of, you know, nobody's going the extra mile. Nobody is very happy about how things are going. So it just had that slower, sadder mood of a socialist country. And I think that's an important thing to recognize because, you know, as they say, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. These other countries, New Zealand in particular, for the present circumstances, need to pay attention and realize, you know, this is a slide that in the UK has been happening. And then with Keir Starmer's election happened very quickly to where it went from a UK that was very British to a UK that feels like a very socialist place to be.
Socialist or Islamic? Because I understand Islam has now taken over Christianity as the dominant religion in the United Kingdom. I mean, that would be a bitter pill to swallow for the Church of England.
Yeah, that's tough. Just speaking to my personal experiences where I happened to be and what I happened to encounter, I ran into a great deal of that the previous time I was in the UK, and by whatever chance, ran into virtually none of it this time. So I can't comment to that.
Since the grievance studies affair, and thank you for now ticking off my grievance studies bingo card, you're the last square in the box. How have things changed from an academic standpoint? Because, I mean, the entire point of that was to highlight some of the hypocrisy and absolute insanity that was going on in publishing within academia. Have things improved there, or have they gotten worse, or are they about the same?
Yeah, I generally think that kind of all three things have happened, but the overall impression would be that they're mostly the same, that it's mostly just kind of entrenched. But all three things have happened. There are ways in which the universities seem to be just detached in a bubble and have decided to just continue down this path at an accelerating rate. And then there are ways in which this seems to be the status quo. But then there are also ways in which it's an open secret at this point. People are just talking about the fact that the universities are a major problem. The denial that you might hear from you know, administrators or whatever else just rings hollow. It just sounds silly at this point. And so it's a weird thing to say that you give these three options. It seemed to be very different, but I think all three of these things are kind of happening at once. There is certainly more talk that there is a fundamental and structural problem at the universities that's connected to and kind of culminating in the output, both in teaching and research, of the scholarship that the Grievance Studies Affair targeted. But at the same time, they haven't given up on this. And while the problem is being recognized by some, the people that are in the problem are protected and continuing it. And then in the middle, it just feels like this is status quo. This is just what universities are now. I was just handed here just a bit ago in another meeting I was in, I was handed a paper that's you know, very New Zealand specific. And it's something like, you know, the 50 reasons why everything's wrong because of something to do with the Maori. I don't remember what it was about, but it is absolutely preposterous. And it was published in just the last year or so. And I don't think that it's a healthy sign that the universities are on a road to recovery to see something that absurd getting, again, a peer-reviewed publication in a not major but not inconsequential academic journal.
The Trump effect with all of this, though, of course, is something that I think a number in academia, just not all, I think anybody that sit on the left side of the political fence didn't expect him to come back for a second time. How will that actually lay out over that sort of cultural milieu, particularly in the United States? As you said, you've sort of potentially you're crescendoing now. He's such a disruptor. Like, it's very difficult to categorize him anywhere. So what sort of things could you expect to see with him, whether it be in academia or in culture in general? I mean, from my standpoint, I'm certainly seeing a lot of hysteria. I think the latest thing I saw was Rosie O'Donnell absolutely crying great big leftist tears about going back to Ireland. Poor Ireland, but that's all right. We've given them Trevor Mallard, so, you know, ask someone there to fill you in on him once we're done. How will the Trump effect accelerate what is hopefully a normalization in this culture that we're seeing at the moment?
That's a fabulous question. And in some ways, it's a difficult question. Like you said, Trump is hard to categorize, but he's also very difficult to make predictions about or around. This isn't specifically about him, even. I do think some of the things that he's going to do are going to put incredible pressure on the institutions, like these, you know, he's more than willing to revoke federal funding for anything that's pushing woke stuff too far. I mean, it's even if he's vague about what that means, sometimes he's more specific. He's going pretty hard with the government's power of purse against them. The bigger sea change, and I think the more interesting part, isn't necessarily what Trump's done. We'll come back to that because it's what he represents that's going to matter to your question. But it's that that Trump, in this case, as we said, as many people, I guess, especially on the left, said years ago, Trump is a symptom of what's going on, or he's a lagging indicator. The population of the United States is frustrated and tired of this. Rosie O'Donnell can leave, and we can say good. Most of us just didn't care. We think it's, so what? You're a celebrity. Get the hell out. We're not interested. It doesn't move us anymore. When somebody starts up, you know, it's like they've got the old crank and the old style automobile, and they're winding up the engine. Oh, the race into blah blah blah, and Americans are all just like, shut up, we're not doing this race crap anymore. I'm gay, and we don't care. Go have a great afternoon. No one cares. You know, the American people are done with it, and this isn't and I say that Trump becomes this lagging indicator or this symptom. Because this isn't MAGA. MAGA is very much that way. In fact, MAGA is a little scary because they're actually actively mad and wanting revenge against the woke. Whereas MAGA was a important and large part of what elected Trump, but Trump had a humongous coalition. And it's so diffuse that coalition isn't even the right word. You had the MAHA people that came with Robbie Kennedy. You had so that they don't all get along with MAGA. You had Democrats who have just had it up to here with the Biden administration or their state governor who for the first time in their entire lives voted for a Republican, and it's Trump. And it's these people aren't MAGA. And you had, you know, meanwhile, you had conservative Christians, for example, turned out at a lower statistical rate in 2024 for the election than they did in 2020 for that election. And so you can't make this case that this was these like just the raging conservatives and the MAGA people came and put Trump in the White House. This is this broad coalition of Americans who are saying enough. So I think that the fact of Trump indicates that the cultural shift already happened primarily in the United States, which is why I'm optimistic that we're kind of reaching the crescendo of this wave. Now, what's the effect that Trump will have as such a disruptor? It's difficult to say. Of course, there'll be pushback, but even people are tired of that. You know, oh, Trump's a fascist, they say, and everybody just kind of says, shut up. We've heard this before. We don't care. You know, that's even the meme with J.D. Vance. I really don't care, Margaret. And this is the attitude. We don't want to hear this stupid, you know, left wing agitprop any longer and we don't take it seriously. What he provides, though, is this opportunity that a frustrated American public did not have when Joe Biden was in the White House. And that is that when this frustrated public says we want this or that to go, we have a government apparatus at the federal level that also wants it to go, instead of one that will kind of very flagrantly not only keep it, but then give it more money because the American people don't like it. So Trump represents this opportunity to have a government that's actually moving in step with the people. And like I said, the risk is that MAGA is actually, in my opinion, being tempted and pushed, and I don't think it's all organic. I think it's largely astroturfed and manufactured, but they're in a position to where they're eager to take steps much further than the broad will of the American people represents, and that actually elected Trump to the position that he's in. So it's a very interesting dynamic, but I don't know, the Trump effect will be that we have a government that will in many ways, I think, be responsive to and actually in agreement with this changing cultural tide. So it might be that he's very successful as long as he keeps working in line with what this broad and politically diverse coalition that elected him is interested in. We want our lives back. We want to go back to normal. Mm-hmm. We don't want any more extremism, and we don't want more identity politics.
Well, and you would have thought that with those identitarian politicians, that with so much diversity across on the Trump side of the camp, that they would be delighted. Isn't that what they've been calling for all along? So then I want you to clear up something around what is currently going on. And since you've been back on X, I mean, your thumbs must be getting RSI because you've been very busy. You're a very prolific poster. One of the things you've been talking about has been the woke right. Now, I listened to your interview with Winston Marshall that you did recently, and I know you were bouncing a lot of ideas and fleshing a lot of that out with him. And one of the impressions I got was to me, it feels almost Newtonian. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So therefore, if we have a woke left, does it then stand to reason that we have a woke right?
Well, no, it wouldn't, but I have been pushing on this a lot. It wouldn't stand to reason that there would be a woke, because we had a woke left, that we're therefore going to have a woke right. Because the fact of the matter is that there are two variables when we use a word like woke left. The woke side should go to not woke if there was an equal and opposite reaction. And the left side maybe should go to right side if there's an equal and opposite reaction. So it's my impression instead that like I said just a moment ago, that I don't think this is organic in the majority of its expression. I think it is, in fact, largely another active measure meant to disrupt and undermine the capacity of the United States to escape the woke tornado. So rather than swinging back toward individual liberty and freedom and this, you know, merit-based society, which is what we've had taken away from us, which would be the natural reaction, we're instead being pushed into this situation of a new authoritarianism with different values. And I don't think that represents a swing back, but rather a purposed swing somewhere else.
So it's almost sort of kind of like skirting around the outside of something, isn't it? You're wanting to, the goal remains the same, but the direction of travel sort of is politically has just gone from one side to the other.
Yeah, well, if you would think of a real pendulum swinging in space, right? And not like a rigid one on a clock that swings just back and forth. Think of one that's, you know, a ball on a string in three-dimensional space. And imagine it's heavy, like a bowling ball, and it's swinging back, and you don't like the direction it's traveling. What would you do? You have a couple of options. One of your options would be to just get in front of it and get hit with it, right? Which who would want to do that? Another option is to start pushing it from the side so that it swings along a different axis. And that is what I think is actually happening, that this natural energy, the energy to push back away from the woke, is being nudged into a different direction that takes it to a different kind of authoritarian response, rather than saying that we can use the mechanisms of free societies like debate and like voting harder, as they call it, you know, elections and so on, which we just proved works. Rather than using that, we're saying no. What the woke right, as we've been calling it, are saying is no. What the woke left proved is if you want to implement power, you have to have power, and you have to be willing to use power. So now it's time to implement power for our values instead of for their values. In other words, their analysis is right. Their formula is right. Their conclusions were wrong, but our conclusions are right. And so that's the, in my opinion, grave error that they are making. But again, I think that they're being led to make that error rather than saying, finally, we're breaking the grip of the woke and we can go back to individual determination. We can decide how we're going to live our lives and we can answer these questions and good people can get into positions of leadership to serve the community and everything else. We now have something very radically different being put forth, which is that it still does come down to power, and it just matters whose values can assert themselves more forcefully as to which ones are better.
So then who watches the watchers in that situation?
That's a good question. I think stepped into the role and I have been attacked for it, really viciously, vigorously, in fact, to come out and say, I don't think that this is what we should do. Maybe I've misunderstood your question, but
no. It's you haven't misunderstood it at all. Okay, because
there have been a handful of people, but it's small. And then the irony of the moment is being told, why do you care about this? This movement has no power. And then I say, well, why don't you speak up with me? And they'll say, well, because I'm afraid that they'll ruin my life, like they're ruining yours, and they're going after these other people. And so there's this weird moment where people recognize that this thing has a reservoir, this movement or whatever it is, has a reservoir of tremendous power behind it. What institutions has it taken? Well, since you won't speak up, clearly your movement, the conservative movement, has been taken because it won't speak up against this. I saw on X this morning somebody say that the difference is that the right will take out its own trash. Well, will we? That's the question. Well, a lot of people aren't willing to pick it up and walk it out to the can because I guess you guys call them bins here. And it's, walk it out to the bin because, you know, somebody will yell at me. But you're in the exact same position where the left was unwilling to take out its trash 10 years ago. And that's the argument, is we have to learn from how the left just got taken over. It was a coup. It was a political and cultural coup in left-wing politics that mostly took place through the first half of the 2010s and I guess leading through the 2010s. And now we're being invited on the conservative side of the aisle to deal with, we have the exact same opportunity and challenge in front of us. And if we're too afraid to do it, then we're going to find ourselves in a similar position. That position is destruction. And so, you know, who's willing to speak up? It's only a handful, but it's growing. Actually, I've been to a handful of big conservative events in the United States just before I came here to New Zealand. And the most common thing that I have started to hear is, what the hell is going on? So a lot of people have noticed that something bad is going on. People have noticed that if you go online, there's anti-Semitism coming from people claiming to be thought leaders within the conservative movement. We've just seen recently from The Blaze, this gentleman, Steve Deese, who has been pretty vocal in kind of, in my opinion, in alignment with a lot of this so-called woke right thinking, that did a show filling in for Glenn Beck on Glenn Beck's actual program about a month ago or so, where I think he calls me out by name, but I don't remember specifically if he does or not. Maybe he doesn't, but he says that this woke right thing is a boogeyman. It doesn't exist. It's preposterous. And now in the last few days, he's like, what is all this anti-Semitism? And he's having one of these guys on his show and taking him apart and making a fool of him. And he's suddenly alarmed. There's this very rapid mass awakening. So I think the watchers are waking up, but they've been asleep for far too long. And the rampant anti-Semitism seems to be the primary reason why.
So, I mean, it's bringing up then faith, because, I mean, obviously you're somebody that's been on the record as an atheist. But one of the things I've noticed is I consider myself faith adjacent, that from a Western perspective, and if we're wanting to move forward, there is actually a place for faith, or at least the tenets that faith instill. What has been the thoughts now in terms of getting that pendulum back, getting that swing back, and finding a balance between those who are wanting control and power coming from the right, the anti-Semitism, but also to those who don't sit necessarily in a faith space but can work alongside those that do?
It depends on what we mean by faith. Like, obviously you're using faith and being faith adjacent, and pointing out that I don't have a religious belief. Charlie Kirk forces me to call myself agnostic, and honestly that's the right word. I have famously been active with atheist programming in spaces in the past, and when we think of the word faith in the religious sense, you know, there are a lot of open questions. I've talked with pastors here in New Zealand. I've talked with pastors all over the United States about the relevance of this question.
You meet with Bishop Brian, I understand.
I met with Brian Tamaki, yeah. And I honestly, nobody was quite sure how this was going to go. And we had a fantastic conversation. I actually quite like the guy. I'm glad somebody is shaking things up a little bit. But I mean, of course, I know a limited context, but he impressed on me that he's got a very genuine heart underneath whatever else seems to be going on. And I got along with him very, very well. There's also faith in the sense of just believing, like reasonable or demonstrated confidence, right? Like, you don't need to have faith in a religion or God to believe that if you go to the dry cleaner, they'll give you your shirt back, but you're reasonably confident that they will. Or that if you practice, say that you've gotten into archery or whatever is the first thing that comes to mind, and that if you pull the bow and let go and pull the bow and let go, and you don't even hit the target at first, but you have this reasonable confidence that if you continue to practice and put effort in, that you're going to not only be able to hit the target, but hit the bullseye over time. And if that when you understand it that way, if we don't have faith that by taking steps to preserve and embody the values that have made countries like the United States and the United Kingdom and New Zealand in particular, for our context, work and prosperous, great, and just wonderful for their citizens. If you don't have the faith that living out the principles that brought us here, that if we live them again, that we can get that back, then I think you're lost. Like for me, with all the attack that I've had recently, a friend of mine reached out to me, saw some of how it was when it kind of got at its pinnacle early in the year, very beginning of the year. And he's a Jewish guy. And he said, well, in our faith, we believe, and Christians believe this too, but he said, in our faith, we believe that if a man renders a service to God, then Satan will attack. And when Satan attacks, Satan has dominion over the world. And so Satan will ruin you in worldly ways. It'll ruin your reputation. He'll ruin your finances. You know, he'll interfere with everything worldly. And what happens, he said, what the Jews believe is that when that happens is God watches to see if you'll remain faithful. And there are a lot of times where you think it'd be easier to just put it all away and just give up. But the you don't have to be religious. You don't have to believe what I just said, the Jewish man said. You don't have to believe the content of that literally to understand that believing that standing up and making a difference, even against adversity, will make a difference. That doesn't require religious faith. And if we don't have that kind of faith, we're getting nowhere. So you can be faith adjacent, you can be faithful, but it's simply not okay to be faithless and faithless in our countries, faithless in the principles that built them, faithless in our ability to, you know, instill those and awaken those in our children who are going to lead us through the proper emergence from this tyranny. I think that the being faithful, and if you are religious biblically, those are the people that win. It is always the faithful that are the ones who are rewarded. The people who can keep that faith, which then inspires action. Faith without works is dead, the book says. But the works come from having the faith. So it's the faithful, not necessarily in God, not that that hurts, but the faithful and those who believe that the world can get better by taking positive action in it, who are going to make the difference. And if we're all faithless, then we're going to get the society we deserve as faithless, as fools.
Sacrifice, like those often that carry faith, or they understand sacrifice. And when you understand sacrifice, often it's easier to be more courageous to stand up with these bad ideas. And for me, wokeism is something that can only flourish in an environment of affluism, which then brings with it a narcissistic and selfish tendency. So I guess that's also understanding a sense of selflessness and a sacrifice, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And you're right. Woke can only thrive in affluence. Communism can only survive in affluence. All of these totalitarian programs work off of the largesse of people working hard and producing. And the reason is because your economy is only possibly positive sum when people are able to take individual initiative. I gave there was a thread I did on Twitter. It wasn't exactly a lecture. I'd like to form it into a lecture, I think, where I discussed at the fundamental level, the point of what we call capitalism as an economic system is the communists say it's a system of scarcity because scarcity determines prices and because the fundamental right to exclude and property rights generates scarcity. So they say capitalism is intrinsically an ideology of scarcity and of profiting off of or exploiting scarcity to profit. And that's wrong. Capitalism is actually an ideology, an economic doctrine, I should say, if we'll use the word capitalism for it. It is an economic doctrine of surplus, and that generated surplus is what makes the prosperity, but it requires freedom to be able to make the surplus in the first place to get the surplus. And why is it a doctrine of surplus? It's a doctrine of surplus because at the fundamental basic level of capitalism or this kind of thought is, I'm good at making this thing and other people would want it, but let's say it's something that people want it because they need it, right? It's not just a want, it's a need. Although it applies more complicatedly if we extend it. So you generate a need, maybe it's some kind of food or whatever for people. And you, if you only generated the amount that you need, no surplus, you wouldn't give it away. You might not sell it for any money. But if you say, I'm good at growing corn or raising beef, and I can make more beef than I possibly need, what you end up with is not just a bunch of beef or corn that you don't need, but because you don't need it, you also don't want it. Therefore, you're going to be very willing to part with it in voluntary exchange. In other words, the economic utility of that particular commodity is lower for you than the market price. So you are incentivized to produce a surplus of things that you're good at producing because they are below market price for you in value to you, but at market price in value for others who will then give you market price. So you profit from selling it and they profit from buying it. And that's how when everybody's doing this in some sense, on some level, everybody's producing some degree of surplus. And what happens is you get a rich and prosperous society. So this capitalism is, the communists, of course, lie about everything, is not a doctrine of scarcity. It is a doctrine of surplus. And they are, when you have surplus, you have all these people who start to ask the question. It's almost funny. It's almost like Chesterton's fence, right? So G.K. Chesterton has this famous analogy about a fence. He says, you know, it's a parable. If you come across a fence and you don't know why the fence is there and you say, we need to get rid of the fence, he says that the only responsible way to do that is to understand what the fence was for first before getting rid of it. So we have all this principle of industry and surplus and profit as the incentive to make surpluses. And we end up in this affluent, abundant society. And then you say, well, if we have all this abundance, why do we charge people money? How is it moral or justifiable that somebody makes a profit off of a surplus that they don't even want when they could give it to somebody who needs it or wants it too? And you get this twisted idea. This is the communist idea. And you say, well, oh, because he's withholding it so he can make a profit. And it's a doctrine of scarcity. And this is how they invert it. But what happens is this can only take place when you have the affluence sufficient to forget why making a surplus was good in the first place. And so wokeism and communism, socialism in general, are all doctrines that flourish when we are in an affluent state, because when starvation comes, there is none of that. There's no time for that. There's no energy for that. Reality has come back into the picture and reminded us that the good times require us not just to work, but to work in the ways that we just described, and to enter into these kinds of trade. And this is the tragedy, I guess, of Marxist thinking, really, is that the affluence that we can have, that you know, that brings prosperity, also brings with it forgetting what prosperity was about in the first place. And then you end up in this cycle of destruction before people remember to rebuild and go back to making surplus. I guess that was a really long and weird answer to the question you asked, but
no, but it also you strip people away from their own self-agency and aspiration. And if you strip them away from self-agency and aspiration, what are you left with, you know?
Yeah, you're left with the vibe that I experienced in the UK when I went over there a few weeks ago, which is those were the things that felt like they were missing, agency and aspiration. You know, we went to this restaurant, to a pub, and of course the heat didn't work and nobody had fixed it. And the automatic door was broken so that it wouldn't swing open and closed on it. You know, the thing wouldn't close it on its own. The I guess hydraulic, it's not a piece of technology, I don't think, or maybe they had an electronic one, I don't know. Well, it was broken. So the door, if somebody pulled it open, your assumption is it'll close behind you, because that's what all doors that look like that tend to do. So every time somebody opened the door to the pub, which had no heat, they would leave the door open and walk on in. So you have the hostess. This person's job is to tend the door, greet the people, take them to a table, get the process started. And she's standing there by the door, right by the door. And the door gets opened and the people come in and she does what she does. And she goes back to her station and she stands there, looking at the open door in the freezing wind coming in off the river, 30 degrees out Fahrenheit, so zero roughly, you know, Celsius, and just stands there in this restaurant with no heat. And we went over and talked to her. I was like, can you close the door? And she's like, yeah, I didn't think of it. And then this happens again. And she just stands there. And eventually she just kind of says, well, it's not really my job. So actually, we ended up getting up from our table dozens of times to close the door behind people who came in who didn't know that the door wouldn't close automatically. And this was just emblematic. I heard from so many Americans who had their first trip to the UK, and they said, does anybody here care? And that's what you end up in.
Yeah, which is definitely something that you want to aspire not to be ending up in. So one of the things that has changed, I think, the dynamic with so many things now is, you're here on a free speech tour. You're back on X. What difference has Elon's purchase of Twitter and creating X as a free speech platform made to the overall cultural milieu in the last few years?
It's had a lot. And I think some of them are undeniably good, and some of them are, we're going to have to be ready and willing to admit, undeniably bad. He's done a lot of different things as well. So one of the things that it has done that's very good is, as my friend Brett Weinstein has said many times, one is a special number. I would argue, and would love to sit down and talk to Brett if we get the chance, to say that two is a special number too. And I'll tell you what I mean. So what Brett's argument is that when you have zero outlets that allow freedom of speech, you have completely controlled speech. But when you have even a single outlet that allows free speech, everything in your society changes, because there is a place people can go to hear arguments that might be true outside of the official information. So one is a special number. Now, two is a special number if I had to argue with them, because that introduces competition between the two that are offering this opportunity for freedom, so that they can't take shortcuts and get around it, or in some other way, where one is a monopoly, two is competition.
And two
So
is naturally balanced.
that's right. Well, maybe, but two is competition, which creates incentives that don't exist under monopoly. Monopoly advantage, I guess. So it undeniably allowed us to ask questions and share information that would not have been possible otherwise. It allowed us to do exposures of our governments that were not possible and were provably not po were not possible just a few years earlier. And that has undeniably had a gigantic effect on the political environment in the United States, not least waking people up to the fact that a change was definitely needed. And Trump's election is certainly downstream from that. So it's had undeniably big effects, some of which I think are also undeniably positive, because one is a special number. Now, on the other hand, and this was always the concern. I remember when he said he was going to buy Twitter, I said on the, I had not yet been kicked off. I said that what you'll see is infiltrators and members of the left. And I hadn't thought, how naive and young I was and fresh-eyed and summer child. I hadn't thought of the foreign influence campaigns that, hostile foreign entities like China and Russia would, and Iran and Qatar would take advantage of a free speech platform to flood the zone with propaganda and bots. But when I said, when he bought it, I said the left, and maybe to the degree that this is real, the deep state will certainly get onto this platform and fill it with vile and toxic content, racism, sexism, homophobia, awful, not even just sex, like awful stuff, and use that as an agitation point against the free speech nature of it and clamor for speech restrictions to be put back on. And certainly some foreign countries have tried to apply those to X, and so far Elon has been very successful in preventing that from being the case. Famous cases, though, I think he had a one with Brazil. There might have been one with Germany. I don't remember if that one's true or not, but at any rate, this has undeniably happened. And I don't know if they're agents provocateur. I don't know if they are the long banished and lost alt-right in genuine fashion. I don't know if they're Russian or Chinese, Qatari, Iranian, or whatever other hostile entities, or all of them. In fact, I think it is all of what I just named and probably more have flooded onto X. It's certainly that there was a large and intentional matriculation from Gab, which was run by Andrew Torba and became kind of well known in the internet subculture as a haven for pro-Nazi kind of propaganda, anti-Semitism, and racism. And Gab basically migrated en masse to Twitter when it opened back up. And certainly that the quality of that kind of discourse has gone vigorously bad. From what I understand, Elon is trying to combat this problem, but that these people are using very sophisticated tools so that they can figure out. So Elon won't ban them because that would be censorship. So instead of banning them, he's trying to algorithmically deboost them and boost other things instead. And these people are running sophisticated tools, including AI tools, that allow them to figure out the changes to the algorithm extremely fast and get back up to prominence in their placements. So certainly that's not been good. And this has created a problem that nobody knows how to solve. And I know that people are working on it and they don't know how to solve. So that I think has been damaging to our discourse in a lot of ways. Although generally I would prefer that people with odious views are airing them and having them countered in real time and all this. I don't know that that's quite the case for armies of bots funded by a Russian bot network or a Qatari bot network or whatever else, by $1 billion or so of Chinese influence money from their military pouring in to create false narratives and false perspectives across the platform. In other words, I'm much less worried about actual neo-Nazis than I am about scalable bot activity that they don't seem to have any capacity to screen. The monetization of X has completely transformed the platform once you get to a certain echelon of qualifying and then having enough engagement to get any money out of it. I certainly feel the pressure, and I'm clearly not doing it right because I've lost most of the money that I had been making off X by speaking the way that I speak now. Apparently, I speak true, even when I lose 75% of how much I was getting paid month to month or whatever from X. But the pressure is always there. If I tweet this way or post this way, I'm more likely to get more money. And if I don't, then I won't. And if I curry relationships and favor with these influencers and I kiss ass to Elon Musk, maybe he'll retweet me and all of this. And those pressures are always there. There are ways that that system can be gamed. I did a podcast about this recently for an hour, talking about all these different ways that violate X terms of service, where you can game the algorithm that gets you can get you very high engagement, that can then turn around and get you large payouts. So the monetization completely transforms the algorithm and the structure of how people interact on the platform in a way that I don't think optimizes for productive political discourse. It optimizes for, in fact, weird out of like left field conflicts that blow up for 3 days so that all the influencers end up in the center of all the big posts and retweets and make an extra, you know, $5,000 this month by doing it.
So then that is actually how do you sift fact from fiction and sort of commercialization from free speech, isn't it?
Well, yes. And on an even deeper level, not just that, how do you separate a real issue of some importance from one that was a manufactured phantom of a bunch of influencers who wanted to gin up a controversy because they make money by being at the center of a big controversy that got ginned up? So when's a controversy real and when is it a cynical opportunity for people with big accounts who are networking with one another in group chats behind the scenes and Discord servers behind the scenes to come up with a way to say, this is going to be the next big thing we get everybody on the internet arguing about for 5 days so that we get 30,000 retweets on every single post that we post about it or whatever, and make an extra, like I said, $5,000 or $10,000 for this month that we get to pocket off of the monetization algorithm. So you don't even know now when the discussion you're having is being had, not even for political warfare purposes, but just out of influence deciding if they can blow something up, then they can make money off of the fact that they got something to blow up.
Yeah, insane. Oh, look, there's
and
so
I feel
many-
like the H-1B debate. And it took over the United States on Christmas. On Christmas, it's a very weird day to have a weird debate about immigration policy. This debate, I feel like, was one of these. It started as one of these influencer manufactured objects in order to get people sitting around after Christmas dinner, all going to argue about something, and the influencers are going to get tons of retweets and reposts. And it's the one thing nobody's ever talked about up until this point, except this one organization that cared about it. And now everybody has to talk about it completely all the time. And it's the most important issue ever. And everybody has to have an opinion. I think that was one of those. I don't think there was even a real debate. And then it turned into an absolute propaganda battlefield. A foreign influence got dragged into it. You could tell the influencers lost control of this conversation because they started within a day or two. The ones who started it were saying, wait, where is this going? Why are we talking about this? This is getting so racist. I didn't mean for it to go like this. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, this wasn't even a real debate. And then it turned into a psychological operation against the conservative movement to split it over immigration, fueled no doubt by Russian or Qatari or Chinese or hostile activity that wants MAGA torn apart so that Trump's neutered, so that Trump can't restore the dollar, so that BRICS rises and the Belt and Road Initiative takes over the economic backbone of the world.
Oh, see, don't open that Pandora's box or we'll be here all day. Hey, look, one last thing before we go. What is the one thing that gets you out of bed in the morning? What fires you up to keep going and keep doing this day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out?
Well, you've asked two questions here, and just as by way of being funny, I have to pee in the morning usually is what gets me out. I'm kidding. I got asked this last night, actually, and I'm going to say this wrong. There's something about Americans, and apparently we don't speak Maori or whatever language it actually comes from, and I apologize that I don't know. But I was in Tauranga. How do you say that?
Tauranga.
Yeah, okay. So I was there last night, and I got asked this question by one of the gentlemen who came to hear me speak, you know, what motivates you? What keeps you going? And This is one of those questions you waffle on. You don't know what to say if you haven't really thought about it. A lot of times we aren't that aware of our motivations. It just seems like the right thing to do, you know? And so I had this weird experience. This is what I told him last night. I went to an event in Utah. My friend Jason was hosting the event, but he was also speaking a little bit. He wasn't like a slated speaker, he was the MC. And he was going to say a few words either at the beginning or end or both. I don't know. And he had had a friend, a close family friend, die a few days before and had attended the funeral that afternoon. And of course, attending a funeral for a close friend puts you in a different state of mind than you would have been in otherwise. Memento mori is a real phenomenon. And so he's very reflective and he's an emotion-led guy in a lot of ways anyway. And so he's emotional and he's saying, you know, I've asked myself, you know, and here I am at this funeral thinking about this. Why do I do this? And he says, like, I've always said that it was for my kids. And he's like, and I realized, you know, today with everything going on, it's not. And it's always for my family and it's not. And it's for the kids, you know, all the kids and for the next generation and it's not. And it's for the community, it's for the nation. You know, we love America and it's not. And he's like, I do this every day. And he has major troubles, like legal troubles. They come after him too. Very hard, challenging. He has a very nice life, as Trump puts it. He has a very nice life. He could just live his very nice life. He doesn't have to do this. And he said what he realized, reflecting on this in the wake of this funeral, is that he realized that if he were to walk away from it, there's not a day his soul would let him rest, knowing that he can say something or do something and make a difference. Or maybe it's a small difference, maybe it's a big difference, but his soul would not let him rest to not get engaged. And so it's almost this kind of compulsion or in a religious sense, a calling. And honestly, his answer is my answer. That is what it is. Every single day, I mean, I've had this conversation with my wife a dozen times, dozens of times. It's not always fun. Some days I get to go to New Zealand, and that's pretty cool. Some days I have to go to Utah. No, I'm just kidding. Utah's all right too. But it's hard sometimes, right? And but it's if I have I tell her all the time, if I walked away from it, just got a regular job, just went back to doing the job I was doing before or whatever. How am I supposed to sit with myself knowing, you know, what difference I have made and can make and knowing what I know about what's going on? Am I supposed to just put my head in the sand and pretend? Am I supposed to go back into the matrix and eat my juicy steak knowing it's fake? What am I, how? How? And so his answer is my answer. My soul wouldn't let me rest a day. So I wake up in the morning and I wonder, you know, what shit lies around this corner every morning. And, you know, 9 days out of 10, it's pretty good. And one day out of 10, it's pretty bad. And you get up and you do it again because you have to. Something won't let you rest if you don't. And I think that's what keeps me going. That's what gets me out of bed is it's just knowing it's the right thing to do. And that for whatever reason, the way I'm built is that if I don't do what I think is the right thing to do when I know what it is, that I'm doing something wrong. And of course, that's biblical. In fact, I learned that from a Kiwi, my favorite based Kiwi. Trevor Loudon says this all the time.
Oh,
Well, yeah, he's one of the, it's one of his
yeah.
favorite Bible verses to remind people of, which is great for me because it's James 4:17. And it's for he who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, it is a sin, which of course sounds great in a Kiwi accent when he says it. So I think it's that. I think it's that. If you know the right thing to do and you don't do it, you're sinning, and I can't do that.
No, well, thank you very much for continuing to do it. And of course, you're on X at Conceptual James. So if you want to have some entertainment, you certainly entertain us all very frequently. Yourdiscourses.com is your website. Is there anywhere else you'd like to direct people to while you're here?
No, those are the two. That's you know, any of my social medias, I'm on all of them except Facebook at Conceptual James. And the website is newdiscourses.com. Don't miss it. Go to the podcast, the New Discourses podcast, wherever you listen. That's where I do my, I think, primary and best work now. I'm exploring and have been for a few months now the Nazis rather than the communists. And I think you'll find some of it alarming and enlightening. So I hope you'll look into that.
Awesome. Look, Dr. James Lindsay, it's been an utter joy today. Good luck for the rest of your tour, and thank you for talking to us today at RCR Talk.
Yeah, thank you very much.